This is Gary Lactus in his car, which has the motor on. Sorry about the background noise. It's very cold. I'm trying to keep warm.
And this is the Beast Must Die, safely ensconced in my lovely warm room. And I am not cold. I am warm, and I therefore win.
You are indoors, are you? Yeah, in your castle. Marvellous.
Yes.
Sorry, you broke up a bit there. Great. Just great. After last episode's actual silence. yes, hopefully this one will go a little bit smoother. This one, of course, you're listening to Silence, issue 288. That's right, I'm prepared. I've written down the number of the episodes, so this is going to be beyond professional, apart from the increased background noise in my car in space.
Beyond professional, that's our 2021 motto.
Oh, Happy New Year, everyone.
Happy New Year. We were going to record this last night, but just before we were about to record, I wrote to Gary Lactus and just said, might be a bit late with the recording, Trump supporters storming the Senate. Which is definitely a fun text to send. And then obviously we both got a bit caught up watching the unfolding dum-dum coup. And so we didn't record last night, but hey, everything, yeah. Peace has been restored and democracy's back in place, so we thought let's get on it,
and everything's fine. Yes, I mean, we could talk about that, but I don't think my main takeaway from it was one of the things I noticed was a big flag with Donald Trump's head photoshopped onto the Rambo poster.
Yes.
Sylvester Stallone's muscle-bound 80s body with Trump's head. And your takeaway was a very big Make America Great Again cap.
Yeah, the fucking biggest.
Someone was wearing a really comically big cap. yeah. Apart from that.
Yeah, everything's fine. This is our post Christmas episode. Sorry if last episode was a bit of a downer. it wasn't very Christmassy, and I did actually manage to have an okay Christmas. Locked in my house with my family, it was quite nice. Watched a lot of films, did a lot of Christmasing, and didn't see any other humans. It was wicked, but. We are here to talk about comics and comics alone. But the only thing I'd say, it's not only comics, sometimes it's other things, right?
Comics related media.
Exactly.
And also places you can buy comics, like Dave's Comics of Brighton, who no longer sponsor me, Gary Lactus.
And
yet there they are, still getting mentioned. That's Dave's Comics of Brighton.
Presumably closed, yeah.
Closed, yes. Currently
and
closed.
I'm sponsored by Gosh Comics of London. They're closed, I think, but they are fulfilling orders and things like that. So I do urge you to go online and buy stuff off them if you can, because support them. They are a wonderful place, and I'm a fan of them and their staff monkeys who work there. Now we've got that great bit of sponsorship sorted. What I wanted to tell you about was that there was a thing I watched that was comics adjacent.
Mm-hmm.
And that was... it's a section we're calling Silence, because I'm watching the fucking telly. and I watched a big chunk of the Doom Patrol TV show.
Hmm. Yes, I'm interested. I haven't watched it yet. Happy you have, so you can tell me what to think about it.
Yes.
Please.
Well, I had to sign up to a thing called Stars Play, where you got 7 days for free, and I had a bit of time off before Christmas, and I was like, I found myself with a bit of spare time, because Mini Beast was still at nursery. So I was like, hey, I can watch some stuff. just guilt-free, reasonably guilt-free. So I signed up for the 7-day free trial, and of course I'm still paying for it now, because, of course. But, yeah, I enjoyed this. I'd wanted to see it, because part of me sort of couldn't believe, really, that there's a TV show of what is essentially Grant Morrison's Doom Patrol. And, you know, what I think is quite funny about it is that Morrison himself, because he wasn't involved, he wasn't, like, brought in as a script consultant or any of that stuff, he sort of hasn't really... I haven't seen him sort of mention it much. He's very, very keen to talk about, like, Happy and stuff like that, because he's involved in that more directly, and Brave New World, which I understand, but he should be, like, hugely flattered. I mean, unless he's not getting any cash for it, which I'd be surprised. I'm sure he got some rights for some of that. But I don't know, maybe not some rights.
I wouldn't be surprised.
Well, I mean, he must be getting royalties off. I guess, no, not off. He wouldn't get anything for the characters. No, that's true. Anyway, whatever. But it is very much a Grant Morrison's Doom Patrol show. It incorporates some other elements. It brings in Rita Farr as Elastigirl. And it sort of brings in, like, Cyborg as a character because... Well, I don't know. I mean, I guess they wanted to have a black character in there for one thing. They wanted a bit more of a diverse cast, although it is reasonably diverse anyway, because Crazy Jane is played by Diane Guerra, who you might know from Orange is the New Black and some other stuff. But they bring in Cyborg as well, and he fits okay, because essentially the Doom Patrol is a show about a support group for people, PTSD suffering, but sort of people who've kind of had life-changing injuries, really. That's kind of what it is, which works surprisingly well as a TV show as well. That kind of support group it manages to make it quite moving. I mean, much in the same way that Morrison's run on the comic was that, really. It just adopts that. You've also got Brendan Fraser playing Cliff Steele, or rather the voice of Cliff Steele, and occasional bits of flashback to him being Cliff Steele. And Brendan Fraser's quite good, because he's got, like, a big mullet and he's put on quite a bit of weight, and he looks quite good. He's sort of, like, gone to seed matinee idol looks work quite well for Cliff Steele. And Timothy Dalton as the chief, that's great. I mean, you know.
Yeah, that's great casting.
That is great casting, and Dalton is great. I love a bit of Dalton. The best Bond, in my opinion. I mean, not really. It's just the one I went to the cinema to see. I went to see The Living Daylight, so that's the one, the only Bond film I really give a shit about. And I can't even remember what happens in it. It's just the one I went to see. So he's in it, and who else? What's his name? Shit, I can't remember. The guy who plays Larry is, I think he's called Matt Borman or something like that. I recently saw him in The Boys in the Band, which was is a very well known play about it's a seminal gay play, New York gay play, and they recently did a new version of it with an all gay cast on Netflix, and he was in that, so I recognised him, and he plays Larry Trainer. So there's a few changes they make, and instead of Negative Man being a hermaphrodite, they play more with the idea that he was a sort of repressed homosexual fighter pilot. And so there's a lot of stuff about him kind of coming out, and this thing that's trapped inside him, and they play with that instead of the hermaphrodite stuff, which is, I can see why they did it from a dramatic point of view. But it's a bit of a shame, because especially at the moment, I think Rebus is a really good character who could have done some good stuff with the whole hermaphroditic kind of he, she, her stuff that Morrison was playing with. It seems just quite sort of like that now will be the time to take that on. So that's a thing, I guess. But, you know, it's pretty good. It's pretty good. It's not perfect. Are some, you know, it is still a TV show. So there are points at which you are sort of aware that drama is being wrung out perhaps a little too long, or they lean in quite hard to Crazy Jane, which is understandable, and she's really good. Don't get me wrong. I think she's great, and she does a fantastic job with all the different personas and things like that. But they lean quite hard into kind of how messed up Jane is, and how I don't know. They just. She's the one that lends herself to a lot of the sort of dramatic focus, and that can be a bit of a grind sometimes. It's not as much fun as some of the other stuff, but it is really weird seeing like Mr. Nobody as the main baddie and Danny the Street. Danny the fucking Street's in it, and it's like the Danny the Street episode is amazing. It's really well done, and the actual evocation of Danny is so perfect. Like this amazing street full of just like all these wonderful like free characters, and you know, that just talks to people with this like steam coming out of manholes and letters rearranging themselves on windows. It's like genuinely quite like, I don't know, I kind of got a giddy thrill that I haven't got from any of these superhero things recently, just because of the personal connection I have to that run. You know, it's such a favorite run of mine, and it was so important when I was growing up, that actually seeing like Danny and Flex Mentallo and the episode where they go into the underground and it's like Jane in the underground, all the stuff that actually happened in the Morrison run. It's so weird. You know, the men from nowhere, Mr. Jones.
Yeah.
No, not Mr. Jones. Who's the guy? The guy, the agent, the Normalcy Agency. What's his name? Oh, I can't remember. The guy who looked like Bob Dobbs.
Right, yeah.
He's in it. You know, they changed some stuff. They're sort of liberal with the changes, and that kind of all makes sense. But fucking hell, you know, there's like Mr. Nobody, and it actually looks like him as well. It's Alan Tudyk or Tudyk. I don't know how you say his name.
Tudyk, yeah.
Yeah, he plays Mr. Nobody and does a really good job, and he narrates it as well, which is really good. So you've got this quite Milligan-esque, distanced, ironic narration, like meta narration, obviously, because Mr. Nobody sort of is this kind of Dadaist supervillain. He's talking about it like it's a TV show, which is really good. So it adds this kind of fun playfulness to it. You know, it's kind of wild, and it leans into the weirdness really well. It's definitely one of the weirdest TV shows. I mean, it's not like David Lynch weird, obviously. It's a much more bubblegum weirdness. But you are still like watching this going, fucking hell, I can't kind
did
of
you
can't
see
believe.
Legion?
I did see some of Legion, yeah.
Because that was pretty weird.
Yeah, I think Legion
is the same kind of
comparable. Yeah, comparable. I think Legion was more
interested. That was sort of stylistically weird.
Yeah, you know? I don't think Doom Patrol is. I think Doom Patrol doesn't take as many risks. I mean, it sort of does, but it's a bit more, in a weird way, it's a bit more linear, but that sort of makes sense.
It's sort of straightforwardly told weirdness.
Yeah. The weirdness is like
weirdly,
you know,
told weirdness.
Yeah, exactly. So they're quite linear episodes. They don't jump around. They don't sort of confuse you. But you will have like, you know, like a whole town disappearing inside the a donkey's backside and things like that. And that's kind of, you know, that sort of thing just happens quite regularly.
I could have some fun watching this.
I think you'd really enjoy it, actually. I really do. I think there's a lot of fun to be had. And there are moments that are like really kind of got me a bit. Like the first bit where you kind of see Cliff talking to Jane in the rain when she's painting and he's like, you know, coming from the rain and stuff. I was like, I kind of can't believe I'm seeing this playing out in front of my eyes. It's really like amazing. And I think that the cast is really good. Like I say, Diane Guerrera is really good as Crazy Jane. She gets a lot of, she has a lot to do, and she does it well. And I think that, you know, she's just right, actually, for the role. It kind of slightly updates it. She's not quite the sort of whimsical goth that Morrison had her as. She's a bit more kind of punky and a bit more, she's almost like something out of Love and Rockets in a way. She's kind of got this slightly Hernandez quality.
Do they play up with that? One of the things I remember about Crazy Jane was, she's like this sort of multiple personality thing, and her different personalities but I don't remember the personalities being super distinct. Admittedly, it's been a long time since I read it, but like as a performance, is there a lot of variety there?
She.
It strikes me as a sort of dream role.
Oh, I mean,
for an actor who wants to like flash their chops around.
Yeah, yeah. So she's, you know, there's she does a great job. She, you know, there's like a little English girl called Penny Farthing. She plays, and she does a really good job of this sort of slightly Victorian, you know, flower girl British voice. And then she's like Hammerhead, who's the kind of the really aggressive shit talking one. And then there's a whole episode where she takes on this character called, I think she's called Karen, who's who's basically lives her life like it's a 90s, she's in a 90s rom-com, and she's got like reality warping powers that make everything happen as though it's a, it's really good, it's really funny. And so suddenly she's just playing it in this really kind of perky white girl Rachel from Frenzy sort of way, and it's just really like she's really good. It's quite a transformative performance, and she's kind of super hot as well, which helps. And the other person, April Bowlby, I think she's called, is the actress playing Rita Farr, and she's great because she is doing a whole 1950s movie starlet thing, but she's a kind of movie starlet who's her light was dimming slightly, and she's starting to like turn up in crappy monster movies and things like that. So that's kind of who she is. So she's got this kind of stuck up, dated way of being, which is actually kind of great. And she's like deeply lovable. You really kind of, you kind of like Rita a lot. And, and then I think the guy playing Cyborg, it's a nice take on him. He's not as one dimensional as Cyborg is often played. He's a kind of little bit more nerdy than, like genuinely nerdy. He's like a little, you know how like little guys who get really big and they get really tough when they're quite little. He's got a bit of that going on, and it works. And then there's a certain fragility to him because he's also kind of, you know, he's pretty fucked, Cyborg. He's like, he's most, you know, quite a large bit of him is robotic. And so that it works well in the kind of, it, you know, the support group mentality. Yeah, no, the whole thing is actually just pretty good. My one complaint, really, I think, is that I think it could be more menacing, because one of the things I loved about Morrison's run is that the surreality, when it sort of takes a dark turn, like the stuff under the Pentagon, is really quite disturbing. And there's some real creepiness. The Candlemaker's a really creepy villain, you know, there's all sorts of like bits in it, and the Jack the Ripper stuff and the Scissor Men, all that stuff's quite unpleasant. And it doesn't really have, I think there could be moments that were a bit more tense and unsettling, not quite Lynchian, but I think just a little bit more of that kind of sense of curdled surreality, that sort of Svankmajer stuff might be a bit nice. But you know, that is a minor complaint. It's still a pretty fucking amazingly weird show to be, and you know, whilst feeling like it could exist in the same universe as the like the Flash TV show or, you know, Legends of Tomorrow, it kind of feels like it's of a pit. It feels like the suggested for mature readers version of one of those TV shows, which kind of, I like that. It works. So yeah. What I'm getting at is I want to see a Shade the Changing Man TV show very soon. And actually, I think you could do that. You know, I think that's perfectly serviceable, especially if you sort of played up the fact that he could be a woman as well. I think that would be a really fun, you know, there's no reason it couldn't work. I mean, if you'd sort of said to me a while ago, yeah, there'll be a Doom Patrol show and it will have Mr. Nobody and Danny the Street in it. It's kind of hard to believe sometimes. What a world we live in.
Yes.
Good. I enjoyed it.
I'm glad you'd like that. Another thing, I noticed on the other podcast on this feed, the Savage Beast podcast, we watched Feels Good Man.
Yes.
Which tells a harrowing tale of Pepe the Frog, a two-dimensional creation's journey through debasement and corruption in the third dimension. White apathy does not come off well here. I was wondering, was that you who watched that?
That was me, yeah.
Right, okay. I watched this a few months ago when it was on the BBC, and I meant to talk about it, but I think it was an episode where I had uncannily quite a lot to say. I thought it was like the whole story of what happened is pretty amazing.
Yes.
And kind of terrifying. I was just wondering what you meant by the white apathy thing.
So I found that it wasn't just like, so the kind of nihilism of these 4chan creeps, that's like one form of white apathy, and it's an extreme one, and it's sort of, you know, it's this kind of apathetic kind of apolitical thing that somehow ends up coming into turning into this kind of quasi-fascistic, nihilistic, just, I don't know, unpleasantness that starts to power this role. But actually, I found, like, whilst I really felt for Matt, is it Matt Fury?
Matt Fury, yeah.
I really felt for him, and he seemed like a nice dude, don't get me wrong. But it kind of reminded, like, the whole culture that he is kind of part of, this sort of shrug culture, of which I've been part of as well. I'm not like painting myself as some, you know, committed, politicized, active person or anything. But I just sort of, you know, this sort of, stuff that is what, like, Boys Club is a fun comic, and I've enjoyed it and stuff. And he's a great cartoonist.
Yeah, I went off and read a bit. Yeah, it is a bit like, It's sort of not much of anything, really.
It's kind of 20-something flatmate stuff, really, you know. Hmm. But it's sort of like, I think what I got this feeling of is that, you know, this, it's all part of the same spectrum in a way of like disenfranchisement and disillusionment and apathy and just a kind of ness. And like, it, on one end of the spectrum, you've got it like toxifying and going into this really like horrid place. And then you've got like the whole culture that he's sort of coming from, which is just much more common and much more, but it's similarly like just a bit, I don't know. I just felt like he didn't mean for his character to be co-opted, and it's appalling. Mm. I'd be so appalled if it happened to one of my characters. His sort of,
I was imagining it happening to Cindy and Biscuit.
Oh, don't. Yeah. Oh, no. It's awful.
But what I thought was, like, so the only thing he did about it was kill the character.
Mm.
And it was kind of too late for that.
Oh, yeah.
His other option would have been to, like, really step up production of work on that character and make that character really explicitly anti everything it was standing for elsewhere. I think that's the only real decent option you have there, you know. Whereas, like, just killing it and killing the character and sort of, yeah, it does say something, but it doesn't really say enough. And it's sort of, it's kind of washing your hands of it as well, you know.
But it isn't, like, it's funny because I sound like I'm being hard on him. And I guess I am a little bit.
No, I absolutely love the guy, you know. He seemed like an absolutely lovely man. Yeah. And I completely understand, you know, where he's coming from throughout all of it. Mm. But, you know, I just think there were more options. There's more he could have done with it.
Yeah, and I think, you know, there's a bit where Johnny Ryan is like, you know, I just said to him, you need to start suing him. You need to start getting people to take it down. But there is something genuinely terrifying about this. You know, it's like the man who fell to earth or something, this kind of, like, this innocent thing going out into the world and just being debased and broken and coming out like this evil version of itself. And yeah, it's just really, like, I found it a really potent sort of metaphorical watch, really. It was really good. I do recommend people watch it. But I think I felt like that everything coming out of it was just this, like, people, we need to be more engaged with the world. That's what needs to happen. People need to be more engaged in a real way, and it's in a meaningful way. I'm not quite sure what that looks like. I think the generations that are coming, he's kind of he's a bit younger than us, probably a lot younger than us, depressingly. But, you know, he's still part of that sort of millennial Generation X-y world.
Yeah, I'd say it was more Gen X-y than millennial.
Yeah, and the Generation Z or whatever it is, this current, you know, that's not how they are. They're a bit more like, well, you know, you look around you, it's the Greta Thunbergs and the Parkland shooting survivors and, you know, all these deeply politicised, conscientious, active people. You know, I feel like that's a good step in the right direction, because I think that there's a kind of end point to this sort of, like I say, shrug culture. It's like, well, but actually we're running out of space and time to be like that, because we can see that that's actually been quite problematic, and it's left a, like a void that's been filled by some really unpleasant shit. So, you know, that's kind of, I guess that's what I meant, really, was that I felt like whilst a while back I would have gone, oh yeah, I love that kind of shit, I just looked at the kind of comics that spawned it, and I was like, yeah, I mean, it's great. It's a great humor comic, and it's like nicely sort of well observed in that kind of that like deadbeat 20 something lifestyle we all know so well, most of us know so well. But yeah, I just sort of was like, it's almost like I couldn't give it a pass this time. I felt more hard on it than perhaps it maybe deserved. I don't know. But yeah, good, really good documentary.
Amazing documentary. I mean, the documentary isn't about the comic, is it? It's
about the process. Fascinating.
Fascinating. The way it tracks.
So,
the mutation.
Yeah, starting off as this kind of thing that comes out
of this meme is incredible.
And comes out like really, really well done. Forums, you know? Like, what the fuck? It's like that Feels Good Man thing. It starts showing up in these kind of workout forums. And that's where it starts to like, and that's really, that alone is quite like, wow. You know, that would be weird enough. And then it's like, fucking hell. But, you know, the glimpse into the like 4chan, which is a thing I know fuck all about, I was like, this is, bleak times. Just a thing that I don't understand as well. You know, I felt really old watching that. So I don't know this. This is this sort of deep set sort of ironic detachment is so weird and.
Yes, I don't see how it could be so consuming and mean so much to an individual whilst meaning so little.
Yes, I can't imagine.
In reality, you know.
I can't imagine having any kind of hobby like that.
I guess that's the future, you know. You can't go out anymore. You know, I've got nephews who I buy like a series of letters and numbers for every birthday, you know, so that they can type it into a thing and buy things that don't exist on a game, which is all consuming.
Yeah, right. You know? Yeah, I was listening to the Chart Show Christmas special and they were talking about record tokens at Christmas. And I was like, oh man, yeah, I used to love that. You know, they're getting the vouchers and going to Woolworths and buying a tape. And I was like, well, that's no different, I guess, from buying something online. But it just felt so much more, I don't know, it just felt so much more exciting to me, the thought of going to Woolworths, which is weird because, you know, it's not that great. I just got to give a shout out as well, while we're in the non-comic section, to the Chart Music. We've talked about it before, Chart Music Podcast. But the Christmas special this year was phenomenal. 7 hours long. Seven fucking
That's
hours.
What I like.
But that it's is so what
I
like. Weird.
I think the longer it is, the more I like it. And 7 hours was just...
7 hours of chart music.
Chef's
is like,
kiss.
It really was chef's kiss. But it's like time goes weird when I'm listening to chart music. If we made people listen to 7 hours of us talking, I would fully... Not only would we want to kill ourselves by the end of it, but I couldn't imagine anyone wanting to stick that out. But for some reason, it just flies by, doesn't it? Like I'm always like, oh, is that it? It's like, yeah, you've had 7 hours.
because it's fascinating, you know.
It's fascinating.
A thing that is of its time and a cultural artifact which is of its time and just unpack it and unpack it and unpack it. Mm. Whilst being amusing. Yeah, it's good.
And also the actual episode of Top of the Pops that they were doing was absolutely blinding. It had so many good songs on it. It was just like, oh man, that would have been a great Christmas special. And the thing is, 1983, which is when that was from, was that's one of my first like that sort of 82, 83 is when I was really starting to notice the world and pop culture. So I was like, when they did the TV listings, I was like, yeah, I remember that lineup. I can remember that. That's when I was sort of coming into consciousness, I guess, you know, sort of five or six. That's when it starts to kick in, really, the big memories of stuff. So yeah. Anyway, it's cracking. Anything else before we leap into the review universe?
Let me have a look. No.
Okay, let's do it then.
Come with us to review universe again. Again, the beast and you, of course. Oh, excuse me. Did a little Tommy squeaker at the end there. My little Barry Lactus has really latched onto that phrase. He did the other day. He was like cuddling me, and I gave him a big cuddle, and he let out a little fart. Like I was actually squeezing a fart out of him. And I was like, "Oh, you did a little Tommy squeaker," and I squeezed him again, and he did it again. He did it like four times in a row. Like, and we all found it just so hilarious, and now he'll just come up to me just with a big grin on his face and go, "Little Tommy Squeaker." Little Tommy Squeaker. Good times.
And
let's hope some good comics here this evening or today. It's this evening as I talk in my very, very cold car. I guess I'm watching the ice crystals form.
On your face.
We had Christmas in North Portslade. I don't know what you had up in London. Do you have Christmas in London?
We do, but it's a bit better and bigger.
Right, yes. But a bit more quieter and safer down here.
Yeah, exactly.
And previously, for my birthday in November, I had got the complete Calvin and Hobbes.
Oh, wow.
So I was thinking, I really like Calvin and Hobbes. And, you know, recently the Far Side came back as well. I was like, oh, yeah, I like the Far Side. Mm. And I thought, I don't actually have any. I've got a few. I think I've got one of your collections, actually, left over from when you did a children's workshop with Danny Noble.
Ah.
And you left it in the studio, like, forever. So, I was just like,
so it's yours.
I'll have that. You can have that. But, no, I got the complete one, which, you know, this big heavy thing comes in a slipcase. And also the complete Far Side. And I didn't realise at the time they both ended in 95. And yeah, so they both sort of spanned this similar stretch of time. Far Side started earlier, I think it started in 1980. But I've just been sort of reading a bit of one and reading a bit of the other.
Mm.
And like reading, like, you know, the forward in one and a forward in the other. And just these sort of parallel... these parallel strips, these newspaper strips, you know, which is, and of course, like after 1995, that's kind of like they both finished. Newspapers started slowly dying.
And certainly, yeah, cartoons in them were no big deal, really.
Yeah. And it's just interesting reading them. Calvin, I mean, you know, I can't, these are very, very popular strips, and they have been heavily looked at by many people. But yeah, I think what struck me about Far Side, Gary Larson's Far Side, is it starts quite early, and you see him finding his line. Takes him a little while to find his line. The first few are very... they've got a sort of very sort of loose 70s style. Like, definitely sort of... there's a kind of a Head Comics background, you know? In terms of the visuals. And also the other thing that struck me, because most of my exposure to Larson prior to this had been like through compilations and through, you know, calendars, cards, you know, heavily curated stuff. Mm. But this is just all of it in like pretty much in order. And seeing how a lot of it has dated. And I think that's just the nature of straight up gags, you know, which is what they are. Mm. Some of them rely on like cultural references that have gone away. And some of them, I have to say, I don't quite get. But it's a very high hit rate. And you cannot show me the person who's done a daily strip for, you know, for 15 years, who doesn't have a few duds in there. Calvin and Hobbes, however, it is of such an amazingly consistent quality. It really is. I think it's better than Peanuts. It owes a lot to Peanuts, you know. But yeah, and he's very much a cartoonist, you know. You've seen a picture of Bill Watterson, yeah?
Yeah.
He looks like a cartoonist. If you imagine a cartoon, he looks like something between, like, you know, Robert Crumb and, I don't know, some sort of, like, you know, big glasses.
He just looks like an art teacher or something, a nice art teacher from the 80s or, you know, like a real sort of old-fashioned, nice art teacher.
And very, and, you know, just the way he resisted any sort of exploitation of his work.
He's like Alan Moore could learn a thing or two about, you know, about retaining control and being,
amazing given that he didn't have any. I think the only means of control he had was to threaten to just stop. Like, well, if you start making toys, I just won't draw it anymore. I think that was the only power he had.
Yeah.
And he was clearly willing, he was serious and uncompromising enough to, you know, for him to be believed. Just incredible. I mean, Calvin and Hobbes is Calvin and Hobbes. There's no point talking about the work, really.
No, because
everybody knows it so well and everyone sort of, you know, grew up with it. But, just amazing. And having it all there, I mean, it's just something that I will never achieve. I don't think anyone ever has.
It's the high
Larson as well. I mean, there's just the level of invention. You have to read it in small bits. Calvin and Hobbes, you can sort of sit down and read a chunk a bit more.
Yeah, it has sort of arcs, it works, doesn't it? Yeah.
Yes, it really works well in those sort of weekly arcs. And actually, the way it responds to the time of year, that sort of thing. Yeah. The way it's done it and maintained, like, themes that are sort of, by and large, timeless and universal.
Yeah.
Is amazing. It's bloody amazing. And there's loads of it. It's heavy. Even just the single books in the slipcase, they're heavy. There are a lot to hold up in bed.
And some of those...
I mean, I'm a very brave boy for reading it.
You are. You're a big, strong boy as well.
Thank you.
the Sunday strips, you know, those, the ones where he gets to sort of stretch out and explore how to do a page. I mean, that's like groundbreaking stuff. Like, really. I mean, there's one I always remember, which is like this one of Hobbes pouncing on Calvin, and it just plays with all these different perspectives and, you know, close-ups and like little, like just suggestions of movement and perspective changes. I mean, it's just a fucking insanely good page of comics. And that's like as influential to me as a cartoonist as anything like, you know, Frank Miller or any of these other, you know, people that I, you know, absorbed. It's like I think back to some of those actual things that he's done, and also his like his use of snow and the simplicity of his snowbound stuff is just something I've gone back to that well a few times myself, because it's like it's a lovely visual thing, and there's something in the kind of delicacy of his line work and the sort of suggestion of stuff that he does, and then when he wants to do a bit of detail, it's always really incredibly beautiful. I mean, he's just there was a point at which he was getting, you know, everyone was like praising it, because I think it was, like you say, it was one of those things that was in a lot of people's childhoods, and then actually there was this, you know, reappraisal going, hold on a minute, this is actually one of the great kind of cartoonists and one of the great comic works and all this stuff. And then obviously you get a few dickheads on like annoying websites like the Hooded Utilitarian. I remember there was some kind of takedown of Calvin Hobbes, and I was like, oh, fuck off. Just fuck off. You know, it's like, you know, you're joyless cunt. you know, Calvin Hobbes is like, there's like Crazy Cat, and there's, you know, Peanuts, there's Calvin Hobbes. There are these ones where it's like, it may be a cliche or whatever, but it's like, it doesn't matter. They are just astounding pieces of work within the form. And, just, you know, I would love to see some original Bill Wardson pages. I'd love to, like, because going to see the Peanuts exhibition a few years ago that was in London, the Schultz stuff, I mean, it was really beautiful up close, and sort of seeing pencil lines on there going, oh, God, look, it didn't just kind of flow out immediately. He had to sketch it out and stuff like that. It was a real revelation, but they looked so beautiful in the flesh, as it were, in the paper. That I'd love to see what a page, how, you know, I wonder how big Watson is working and stuff like that. And I wonder just, yeah. Do you see any pencil work lines, or do you think he started to just work almost entirely with ink, bit of sketching and then just like all done in ink? It feels like that's kind of how he was working really. But
who knows? I mean, it's very slick. You know.
Oh yeah.
I get the impression with Larson, there's a lot more rubbing out.
Oh no, Larson
really has his moments. There's an incredible. I was really impressed by an early one where he's there's some guys in a hot air balloon, and there's a bird about to peck the balloon, and the perspective is like from really quite high up. It's like sort of mid the balloon. You don't see the whole balloon. So you've got this balloon and the bird about to peck this thing is the biggest thing in the picture. And so there's these two little guys. They're like, it's a kind of like wide angle sort of forced perspective thing. So they're really quite tiny, and with very few lines, he just manages to capture the posture and gestures of like a couple of guys about to like mid realization and panic.
Yeah.
And he does it with so few lines. It's really good. Really does have some really, really good moments. But, Bill Watson's like just peerless, really.
Yeah. I know what you mean about Larson, though. No, he is like his comic time, because it's a, you know, it's a one panel thing with him, and so his comic timing has to be perfect, as in the look on someone's face or the perspective he chooses, the placement of a figure, it all has to work perfectly. And I think I've talked about it before on this podcast, the prehistory of the Far Side book, where he sort of talks about the process a bit, and he identifies some ones that he thinks really work, and some things where he's like, it doesn't work, but I like it still, or it doesn't work, and this is why. And I remember that was like really fascinating to me, just to kind of to unpack a single panel thing. And again, when I was doing Terminus, my single panel comic strip, I had there was a similar thing where like it all came together occasionally, you'd be like, yes. Like that's everything's right there, but there are others where I looked back and I was like, yeah, you've over explained it, or there's too many words there, or it's the wrong moment you've chosen to focus on, or something like that. So it was like, I found that so useful just seeing him break down like his own work and say, yeah, like, because some of the ones where I was like, oh, I like that one, and he's like, yeah, but it doesn't quite work because, you know, yeah, really, really good stuff. Like, yeah, Larson's, they were both like such a big part of my childhood, you know. So I almost forget to include it in my comics reading, because I sort of go, oh, it's cartoonists, and it's like, no, they're comics, you know, they fully are. Mm-hmm. But yeah.
Yeah, yeah. No, great. Just reading these sort of really short form things has been, yeah, it's been good at getting into the real sort of minutiae of what we like, you know, rather than being swept up in a big story. It's just, yeah, it really lends itself to just appreciating the art form on a microcosmic level, you know. It's good. That was fun. Have you read anything, or have you just been sitting around watching films to talk to with your other little mate?
No, I've read quite a few comics, actually. I'm trying to work out which one to do. Okay, I'm going to quickly talk about a Howard Chaykin comic that I've got called Midnight Men, which came out in 1993, a four-part miniseries, came out under the Epic short-lived Heavy Hitters banner, which was a sort of, I think it was about the time that Vertigo was starting, and they were like, hey, we need to do something. So they did like this line of unrelated comics, but it was almost like, yeah, it was like there was a lot of
name creators.
Yeah, that's it. And this is Chaykin, probably his after like his Shadow. So, you know, American Flag, he did his Shadow revamp, he did Black Hawk. I think this is probably his. He then did Black Kiss and left the industry to kind of work in telly for a bit. And this might be when he came back after. Left telly, so it's a kind of, you know, it's prime Chaykin in a way, but I'm not going to tell you about the plot. What I'm going to do is I'm going to give you a little game called Howard Chaykin Bingo. Okay, so
right.
So what it is, okay, is I'm just going to list some things in that, well, turn up in Howard Chaykin comics, and see if you can think how many are in this.
Well, can I guess? Can I guess first?
No, you can't. No. I'm going to read out the list I've spent time writing. Right. So, Lantern Jawed Polish Jewish Hero, who, brackets, who likes slapping women. Sadistic Baddie, who likes slapping women. Stockings and Suspenders. Hollywood Setting. Golden Age of Television. Jazz. A black character with a pencil moustache, who looks a bit like Count Basie. Someone's head getting blown off, someone falling out of a window or being thrown out of a window, repeated panels of headshots, you know, people's heads talking, repeated panels of TV screens, uppity women in pearls with big chests, fascists, literally everyone being an asshole all the time, and cats. How many of those do you think are in Midnight Men?
Well, I reckon all of them except cats.
Nope, it's all of them.
Oh,
it's so weird. I just read it and was like, I mean, this is literally the same as every Howard Chaykin comic. I don't know. There's a weird pleasure to be had, but my relationship to Howard Chaykin is really complicated. It's not actually really complicated. It's really simple. I'm sort of repelled and drawn to him. I dislike his comics. I dislike his characters. I think they are weirdly kind of, they're just cold experiences in a way to read. And yet they are crafted with like consummate skill. And I love looking at the pages. But weirdly, this is quite a dynamic comic, you know, in his way. I mean, it's quite action packed. But he's actually not very good at action. He's good at like static page layout. Like his pages look beautiful, but like he's nowhere near as kinetic as someone like Walt Simonson or Frank Miller, who I consider to be his sort of peers, really, or they come from a similar vibe. His stuff's got this kind of staidness to it, this weird, like, so when he actually has to do action, it's not always like that clear. like what's happening. If he has to draw someone like getting kicked or punched, it's all a bit like odd. But there is just an undeniable pleasure to looking at his pages. Like they are just these like really formally sort of playful, pleasurable. I don't know. There's just something about them. They look great. And he works with like Ken Brusnak and John Workman are the two kind of letterers that he works with a lot. And they really work well with him in terms of incorporating lettering. It's a big part of it, as you know well. But they're so horrible, his comics. They're just all so horrible and so unlovable. And they're just the same. They're all the same.
It really took me a while to realise that, you know. To realise that I don't really like Howard Chaykin comics. But they sort of, there's just something about them. They have a sort of quality of quality.
Yes. They feel like a good thing. But then you sort of like, I'm not enjoying this.
And by and large, I'm bored. By his comics. But no, they do look good. And I think he is he is good at drawing. Surprise, surprise. He can draw. And he's also, he's very fast as well. You know, he's a very natural, you know, his forms come very natural to them. They look good and don't feel overworked, you know.
It's a bit like Steve Dillon or something. You know, he found his groove and he's just like, yeah, I could just do this and that works. But yeah, he always comes across as like a deeply, like I quite like the fact that he's a bit of a bad tempered, you know, miscreant and who doesn't really like play nice. So I think there's too much faux niceness and sappiness in comics creators largely. I quite like these people who are a bit I mean, there's also some deep unpleasantness as well, which we find out, you know, every now and then when the awfulness of certain people is exposed. I get that. I don't want more of that, but what I mean is in interviews he's kind of a shit talker and he's not like, he doesn't have any particular affection for, like, you know, he's not like, oh, I've always wanted to do Superman. He's just like not that interested. He's always really interested in his like jazz, New York in the kind of 30s and women, hot women in suspenders. That's what he really likes. Those are the things he likes the most. But he's definitely, I don't think I'd want to be, you know, trapped on an island with Howard Chaykin necessarily. I could think of other comics creator. I don't think, actually, there's not many comics creators that want to be trapped on an island with.
Just drawing endless Basques in the sand.
But that was a comic. What about you? Got any other comics?
I read Rock the God. I read and thoroughly enjoyed Rock of the Reds, the John Wagner and let's see, what's his name? The artist, Dan Cornwell. It's this script by John Wagner and Alan Grant. I don't know how collaborative it is because it's not signed by John Wagner. You don't see Alan Grant doing it. I heard somewhere, I may be wrong, that it was originally a Wagner and Grant idea that Wagner has then sort of exploited in this, like, recently.
It feels like self-published. Yeah, it feels like it was created in the 80s for a boys' comic. It's got a really old-fashioned vibe to it.
Yeah, yeah.
In fact, I thought some of the early scripts in Rock of the Reds possibly were those scripts because I was quite shocked at how dated they seemed. But that's sort of part of the charm, I guess.
Yes, that is part of the charm. Yeah, it's not, you know, it's not dated as in problematic. It's just dated as in British boys comic, you know, and that's. That is dated, but I still really liked it. I loved how, as Tam put it, I suspect that me and Tam basically have exactly the same tastes, because he's quite often suggesting things, and like, I don't know, I will, like, for myself, for me reading and having a good time, I will trust his opinion now over a lot of people's, a lot of other people's.
No pressure, Tam.
Yeah, yeah. But no, this is great. And I actually found myself, because I was aware of this. I think Bobsy talked about it after a thought bubble, like years and years ago, when you were having some time off with the brand new mini beast. And I was like, yeah. I'm sure it's fun. And internally thinking, football comic, fuck off, you fucking cunt. What are you talking about? The fucking football comic. I found myself in this, Rock is an alien. He has taken on the form of a footballer. He learns to love the beautiful game, whilst at the same time he is alien royalty, and his mother is dying, and she wants him to take over being king of the galaxy. And, you know, it's dated. I love how free it is. I love that it doesn't get bogged down in, like, well, what's the you know, why don't we see a map of the worlds, including you know, intelligent life forms in this galaxy? What's the structure of this society? You know, where does Earth fit into it? You know, it's just like king of the galaxy, and there's some, you know, there's some Skrells or whatever they're called, who are just sort of, they're baddies and they want to take over. So maybe you should become a god. Obviously, our people of our line, our bloodline, have refused to become gods, but you can become a god by you know, communing with the godstones. Like, and it's probably the only way to stop the Skrells taking over. It's like, yeah, okay, I'll do it, but I must get back for the match. And then so there's this whole ceremony where he's talking to the godstone, and the godstone is it's lovely. It's very charmingly irreverent. The godstone is talking to him in his mind, and it's very chatty, and it likes football as well. And all this stuff with the Skrells and the alien attacks, like, yeah, that's cool, and it like does propel things on, and the stuff with the footballer who's been miniaturized, who regains consciousness and is on the loose along with a bent referee, riding around on a skateboard, and like getting captured by some scrawny ne'er-do-wells. I, throughout all of this, I'm like, yeah, this is fun. I'm enjoying this. This is fun. But I really fucking care that that Rock of the Reds gets his team into the Premier Division.
Yeah.
Because there's a big game coming up. And despite everything, despite my history, my entire relationship with sport, I fucking care about this.
Yeah.
I fucking really care about it. And it was, I just really enjoyed it. I just ripped through it, and it was great. Basically, I had such a lovely time.
There is something to be said, I think, at the moment for, like, genuine escapist fare.
Yes.
Like, I towards the end of the Christmas break, I just was like, I fancy watching something big and epic. And so I was just, like, stuck on the Lord of the Rings films, the Peter Jackson ones. And I've watched them a lot, and I've got my problems with them. And, I you know, when you're not in the mood for all that elvish pomposity and everyone being intensely serious the whole time, it can be a bit much. But I genuinely got lost in them. Just the like the scale and the creativity of the worldview and just the high adventure. Do you know what I mean? I was just, and it's because I've just been like everyone else, trapped in my fucking house for a year, and I don't want to watch stuff that is in any way, you know, is it reminds me of that situation at all. And I just really like, and also the world is so like miserable, and there's this constant babble of just depressive noise in things like Twitter and Facebook and everything else, and the news, and just everywhere, you know, that just watching stuff that was so transportive, or reading stuff the way you are literally swept away. And I hate all that stuff normally, in the way that I hate when that, you know, this sort of Neil Gaiman one, transported into the world of story or whatever. But actually, it is nice to just be like, to escape, and to just be in the hands of someone who's doing that really well, be that like Peter Jackson or John Wagner, you know, it's just nice. And like you say, just to care about this football team and to actually be like, oh, that's what I'm worried about at the moment, not everything else. You know, that's what I care about in this moment is this big, silly, fun, transportive story. Yeah.
So, and it's just so solidly written. And yeah, it's just very well balanced.
Well, he's so good, Wagner, isn't he? He's such a understated but great writer. He's so linked to Dredd it's almost easy just to forget how good a writer he is. That, you know,
there's really nothing showy about him. He's so good, you don't notice him writing. You know, you're just sort of there, you know, and you're not thinking, oh, nice conceit. Interesting meta reference. Like anything like that. You're just like, it's just like, bosh, here it is.
Yeah.
Very good.
Yeah. Now, I've been enjoying listening to like Graham and Jeff talking about working their way through the Dredd things in the Drock podcast, because you're sort of reminded of like some of these sort of episodes of Judge Dredd where they're so perfect, the way that they're constructed and the way they're done and delivered and stuff, but they are just what they are. They're like great little short stories. They're not commenting on anything. They are, you know, they're perfectly conceived. He understands the world perfectly. He knows exactly how Dredd should and would react, and he chooses which Dredd he's going to use. You know, is it nice Dredd? Or is it Grumpy Dredd? Is it Dredd the main character, or is it Dredd the supporting character? You know, all this stuff. But he's just so assured that when it hits, it's just like, my God, this is like one of the greatest six pages I've read. You know, there are certain Dredd stories I think back and I think, you know, that's as good as the medium gets in some ways. You know, it's like, yeah, really astonishing writer, really good. It leads me into the talking of that, I got the 2000 AD Christmas issue. Every year I buy this 100 page issue, and then I don't read any more 2000 AD. I'm just mean about
first year I haven't.
Right.
I haven't picked it up.
It's a shame. It's got a cover by Cliff Robinson. He's the Bolland that you can get. what did I think of this? I'll just talk really quickly through each story. I won't spend long, but it's probably the easiest way to do it. So Judge Dredd, Three Kings. It's written by Kenneth Niemand, art by PJ Holden. I don't know who Kenneth Niemand is. I know that Dredd's written by a number of different people. People like Michael Carroll, I think, and they like Rob Williams.
And traditionally Christmas stories are what they give to newer writers. Fucking no one wants to write a Dredd Christmas story.
Yeah, this is not very good. PJ Holden's art is quite nice. It's sort of, it's like a more cartoony version of Charlie Adlard. He's good. It's not boring photorealist work, so I like it. Although, I mean, it's not hugely exciting, but it's nice. It's cartoony, it's chunky, and it looks like a human's drawn it, which I like. And this is Three Kings. Obviously, it's riffing on the Nativity. I wasn't quite sure. He's got a character called Noam Chomsky, who's like a sort of intelligent chimp. I didn't understand why. For some reason.
Yeah, why is that?
Why?
How does that relate to the famous linguist?
And there's for some reason he's got like these clones, and like one of them's Hitler, and I wasn't that keen on that either. I was like, well, I don't think he should be using Hitler in funnies. Doesn't feel right at the moment. Just feels a bit like, now, just can we just fucking not have Nazis anywhere near anything? How about that? And I sort of didn't really like it. It was all right. It was like a bad Dredd strip. Reminded me of like when I stopped reading Dredd because Wagner wasn't writing it and loads of bad writers were writing it. Felt like that. Which is a bit of a shame because I know there are some people who have been doing great work, you know, with the character. Next up, Strontium Dog, Once Upon a Time in Divest, written by Rob Williams, art by Lawrence Campbell. I met Lawrence Campbell when I was painting the windows, doing the drawing on the windows at Gosh. He was also drawing a Dredd. He's a really nice guy. He does, what does it look a bit like? A bit like John Paul Leon or something, that sort of quasi-realistic, quite shadowy, moody artwork. I quite like it in this. I've liked it more elsewhere. Rob Williams, I kind of expected more from this. It's Johnny and Wolf, A Tale from the Past. It's just a bit like, there wasn't much to it, really. I didn't really understand like what the point of it was.
Do you feel about it, given that Carlos has gone and Wagner isn't writing it? Did that colour your...
Yeah, I think one or other of them.
Did you think, oh, it should just end now?
I didn't mind when Simon Harrison was drawing Strontium Dog, because that's kind of when I started reading the strip, and I didn't mind
that's
it.
Some,
I
know. That's some crazy stuff.
It's some good stuff.
I really quite liked some of that.
The strip changed
stuff
as well. It kind of got quite a bit more like political, and it was decent. I mean, it does feel weird not having Carlos involved or John. John and Carlos, my mates. It felt a bit like me. I think like Johnny and Wolf, I think Strontium Dog is a strong enough concept that it can withhold other people doing it. I always thought it was a shame they didn't do a thing. They did a couple of them. They did these Tales of the Doghouse, these kind of one or two part things where you'd focus on a different bounty hunter, often a bit of a quirk. You know, there'd be a story where, oh, it's a bounty hunter who's an elephant, and oh no, he's up against a mouse or something. I don't know. It was all a bit like that. But I thought that was a great idea. I think they should just have carried on. I think they should just have other Strontium Dogs. They've done it a bit with Durham Red and Midden Face and people like that. But yeah, you know, like, I get why you want to have Johnny and Wolf, but I think the mutant bounty hunter thing could just be, there could be more of it. Then we've got a double page spread. I wasn't sure who that was by. It's all right. It said in the year 2020, and all this sort of everything like Dredd and dinosaurs and Slain and I don't know. Yeah, it's all right. It's just a big thing. They've got an article about the Carlos Pino, who was one of these Spanish artists who worked on like early invasion strips. That's nice. You know, I don't mind these little potted histories of people drawing attention to some of the lesser known like Spanish artists as well is welcome. Then the low point in this comic, it was Survival Geeks, A Quiet Night In by Gordon Rennie.
I really dislike Survival Geeks.
I dislike everything about this.
From what I've read of it. I find it abhorrent.
Yeah, I hate it. I hate it. I hate it. It's about it's the Big Bang Theory meets fucking Quantum Leap or something. It's basically like, what if a bunch of nerds actually had crazy nerd adventures? I hate this vision of nerd culture. I hate it. I hate like lovable geek culture. It makes me feel sick. Neil Gugge's artwork is kind of that strain of art that I don't really like. It's a bit like the guy who draws what's the guy who did Chew? It looks like it's that sort of art. Don't really like it.
It's kind of, I understand. I can sort of appreciate it, but I think it's kind of grown out of some sort of hybrid of graph and manga.
That's a good point, really.
I think maybe I'm a man out of time when it comes to that sort of stuff. I think possibly so.
But big hands, skinny arms. Yeah, that's it. Yeah, sort of exaggerated cartoony physicality occasionally and things like that. Yeah, speed lines every now and then. It's also, I really feel like this is like trying to appeal to an audience of which I do not associate myself with that. I never have, and I resent it every time I'm, you know, it's like going to Comic-Con. It's like, you like comics, you must like all this other bullshit. It's like, no, I don't. And that's what Survival Geeks feels like. I hated it, and I'm not going to say any more about it. There are some letters, blah, blah, blah. Visions of Dead World. So they've been doing this, Keck W has been writing it, and Dave Kendall has been painting it, and he was a guy who worked on Psycho. What was it called? It was in Toxic, and it was it called Psycho Killer or something? It was one of Pat Mills's weird Toxic strips, but you would remember it if you saw it, if you get what I mean. It was quite a distinctive, murky, grotesque.
Murky painty.
Yeah, but quite good. I quite liked Psycho Killer in Toxic. It was odd, but it was one of the few things as well that actually finished in the comic, so you could kind of read it as a full thing. And his work is like, he's quite suited to this. So I think it's how Judge Death's world came to be is what it is. Now, whether it's actually that or whether it's a sort of parallel version of it, I don't know. I haven't read enough of it. But I don't mind the idea. I mean, it's cashing in a bit on The Walking Dead, I guess. It's not that it's zombies, but it's that kind of, it feels like that's the thing that, like, almost like a spark for, like, why there might be a strip in this. I don't really know about the shape and texture of this. Visions of Dead World seems to be, like, almost like one-offs set within that world, but I quite like this. It was all right. It was it's a bit nasty, and had a structure and an ending, and I thought, yeah, this feels a bit 2000 AD ish, you know. Next strip, Proteus Vex by Mike Carroll, art by Jake Lynch, and this is in the Nemesis Shakara, you know, a full-blown alien strip, you know, with an alien, a weird alien protagonist and no real sign of humanity. So much more happy with this instantly. And Jake Lynch, it's weird, actually. He's sort of doing like a Henry Flint thing. So it's like, I thought
Henry Flint was doing a sort of,
well, this is it, yeah.
Kevin O'Neill, Mike McMahon, Carlos Esquerra thing.
Yeah, so he's like the postmodern 2000 AD artist in that he synthesized all of them, you know, a bit of McCarthy, a bit of O'Neill, a bit of a lot of McMahon, a lot of Esquerra, all that stuff. Yeah, so he is like this kind of, he's almost like the quintessential 2000 AD artist, while sort of also having this slight kind of after the fatness to him. And so this, yeah, seeing him, someone aping him is quite odd. But nonetheless, I mean, he's really good, and this is, the art's okay. It's nowhere near as warped and fucking interesting as Flint is capable of. But I quite liked this because it was really alien. And I didn't really know quite what was going on. There was a bit of ultra violence in it, and it's episode one of a ongoing. And this was one of the few things where I was kind of like, yeah, I'd probably want to know what happens next. You know, I'd quite be up for reading more of that. So that was good. Then you've got Slain, Dragon Tamer by Uncle Pat, with art by Leonardo Manco, who normally does DC comics and things like that. He does this really like painted, rendered style, which is often looks a bit kind of overworked for something like Batman. Works quite well for Slain, as you would imagine, really. It's a Slain strip. I don't know what to say, really. It feels exactly like Slain always has. I mean,
Did Manco do that Rorschach thing?
Yeah, he did. Yeah, Yeah, that's him.
Right. Yeah, I know it. Right.
Yeah, sort of intensely rendered stuff. And I believe that this was written a while ago and he's taken a fucking age to draw it, I think. Because I don't know that Pat Mills is still working for this. Yeah, I mean, it's just got loads of slang.
He talks like a man who has burnt a bridge.
He does, doesn't he? I'm loving this phase of Pat.
Take I love no blaze of prisoners. Glory, Pat.
Yeah.
Uncle Pat's blaze of glory.
Yeah, it's really good. This seems to involve like Trojans, Greeks invading Britain. Not sure when that happened, but it's in Slane world, it's happening. And this involves Slane just chopping up loads of people with the usual sort of Pat Mills quasi history lesson / odd Celtic mishmash business. I don't know. It's hard to know, really, because I have no idea what's happened in the intervening 15 years or whatever it is since I last read a Slane strip. So, but it looks okay. Mm. It looks all right. You know, it's painted. It's Slaney. It's violent. Then you've
How's
got
Slane looking. Has he aged?
No, he's looking more like a buff. This is kind of buff Californian metal Slane. You know, he's sort of a bit hair metal-y. He looks a bit like, it's definitely like Bisley-esque in his like pretty boy, muscly pretty boy thing going on. I don't know. Yeah, there's sort of, yeah. Mm. Then you've got Hershey part one, Rob Williams again and Simon Fraser. I like Simon Fraser. He's good. He drew loads of like Nicolai Dante, which I didn't like, but I liked his art. And Rob Williams. So this is, there's a strip called Low Life, which last time I read this was Disraeli was drawing it. And, got this guy called Mad Frank or Grumpy Frank or Crazy Frank. I don't know. He's kind of bearded. It basically like, you know, what they called the Wally squad, undercover judges.
Yeah, undercover, yeah.
It's him and Hershey. And Hershey seems to have left Judge Mega City One. She was the chief judge, but she's not anymore. So I'm assuming that's something post that Day of Chaos business. I don't know. So this is them going deep undercover, I think, but I don't know if they're doing it as judges or not. I seem to have missed quite a lot of stuff, but this was good. This was like, I like the interplay between Hershey and this Frank character. It worked. She's kind of like the tough brains of the operation and he's the crazy muscle. And it was good. It was sort of crimey and, atmospheric, and it's set in Ciudad, what's it called? Ciudad Barranquilla, which is Banana City, it's called. It's their sort of South American place. Yeah.
I remember that.
Yeah, there's a good...
That was created by Will Simpson, wasn't it?
Yeah, some really nice stuff that Will Simpson did ages ago, Banana City. Yeah, really. With Crazy Barry and Little Mo, I think it was, the weird... Anyway.
That's right. Yeah, it wasn't a great story, but...
Looked amazing, though.
Yeah. Enjoyed the introduction of a new. I always enjoyed the introduction of a new judge costume from.
Oh yeah, I'll get
that little nerd thrill of like, oh, the world's getting bigger.
Yeah.
I've got an expansion pack.
I'll come to one of those in a minute, actually, but yeah, a separate thing. Then there's a Time Twisters by T.C. Eglinton and Warren Police. Hey, nice to see Warren Police. And this is quite good. I like
Tom Egg as well. He's yeah.
Right. Yeah, you know.
I'm glad you like this.
Yeah. No, this is good. This was like a clever little meta time strip that actually did good things with time. And there's a little bit where it nods to a classic Alan Moore Time Twister strip. And yeah, it's like playfully meta. Tharg's in it, and it deals with some people who manage time. Discrepancies. So it's kind of like the people who manage Time Twisters, really. It's good. It's really good. I enjoyed this. I started off going, oh, fucking hell, you know, here we go. This feels like a bit like an Indigo Prime strip, but it's nice. It's different. It works. And it works really well as a done-in-one. It's got a good twist. It's funny. It's a bit weird. Warren Police is great. It was definitely like a high point. Durham Red. Good. I fucking hate Durham Red.
Oh, I'm glad that's there.
Alec Worley and Ben Wilshire doing a Durham Red strip. She's in prison. I fucking hate Durham Red. She's a shit character. I can just about stand it when Carlos Esquero is drawing her and Alan Grant is writing her, but I really loathe this kind of, she's kind of like 2000 AD's bad girl. So it's like ever since she stopped being in the actual strip itself and having her own things, it's always been this really like kind of quasi Vampirella bullshit. And I just, no thank you. So that is the final strip. I didn't love it. I didn't hate it, but I liked it more than I have liked other stuff, I guess. I feel like Rebellion's sort of hit a real, I think it needs something. Something needs to happen to 2000 AD. There's some good people working on it, and there's some nice strips in it, but, you know, I feel like it's missing a certain spark. And I know it's easy for me to just go, hey,
like it needs a strip about a little girl and a dog, yeah?
It does, yeah. No,
fighting monsters.
I was just thinking it just needs, you know, you need to, like, pick this up and go, where is the bad company or the nemesis in this? You know, I don't just want to...
Where is the autobiographical strip?
Strip about a cleaner.
Being a cleaner, yeah.
I don't know, it's just missing, there's a kind of energy that's missing, and I think a lot of it is to do with the computer lettering and computer colouring that is used, and I think Rebellion, I think they need a better designer working for them. I think it needs a revamp, I think it needs to look better. I think it looks like a sort of half-baked computer magazine a lot of the time.
Now this is, I have just taken a sip of the Devil's Advocate, but... do you think this is, do you think you're up on modern design?
I think I'm up enough on it.
Or
to...
do you?
No, yeah. I mean, I just and, think and it's I, uninspired.
And I'm not saying that in a judgmental way at all, because I really am not. But I do find myself thinking like, oh, that looks ugly. But then finding loads of other stuff that looks ugly. It's like, oh, well, maybe it's cool.
I mean, obviously, I would prefer it if Steve Cook and Ryan Hughes were designing it still. But, you know, no, I think, you know, I think if you think about, I don't know, stuff like Alish Kotz Zero, for example, that came out about 10 years ago, I don't know. But, you know, there's lots of, like, modern comics where I find that, you know, there's quite a lot of stuff coming out where I'm really taken by the dynamics and the design of it. And I don't think 2000 AD necessarily needs to, like, look totally... But it could look a lot fucking cooler than it does. It looks... There's something so sort of meat and potatoes about it. Like, oh, yes, this is what... This.
I must say, like, that logo, sort of exclamation logo of, like, the sort of 2008, it looks like it's just... It looks like a compromise.
It really it does, like, yeah.
Because you've got the 2000 AD and then 2000 AD next to it.
So it's there twice, which is also annoying, yeah.
Yeah, which is sort of redundant, really.
I just feel like it's Matt, whatever his name is, has been editing it for a long time, and I don't know if he still is, actually. He maybe isn't. But I feel like it just needs...
Smith.
It's good, but it's just... No, it's not even that it's good. I don't know if it's good. It's just I would love it if it was way better. So, yeah. That was good though. And the only thing I was going to say briefly when you were talking about judges is from other countries is I bought a very cheap. I got a collection of Judge Dredd Book of the Dead by notionally by Grant Morrison and Mark Miller and illustrated by Dermot Power. And I remember when this came out in the comic, because so they wrote Judge Dredd when they did the Summer Offensive. I think Mark Miller wrote Titan. No, what was it called? Purgatory, which was led into Grant Morrison's Inferno, which was his kind of the evil judges take over the city 8-parter. And it was bad. It was the Summer Offensive, which there were things I liked about the Summer Offensive, but I definitely remember that was one of the first times that I was like, I was so like, Grant Morrison is like a god and can do no wrong at that point. You know, I was literally so excited about the fact that he was going to come back, and Zenith is my favourite thing. Also, you know, blah blah blah.
And
I remember being a bit like oh, this isn't very good. And I feel like his handling of Dredd is the one of the few times there it's like, no, you did not get this character right at all. Your take is really much less interesting.
It also unfortunately coincided with Carlos's
computer.
You know, Carlos.
Yeah.
It was
Carlos.
The introduction of the, like, they're on this sort of hot planet of lava, weren't they?
Yeah.
And it, oh man.
He went to town. Yeah, he got really good with his. He got really good.
I love his lines. I don't like his colours. Like, as soon as, I have to say, God rest his soul. Or whoever, just everyone rest his soul. But when computers got involved with Carlos Escalera's work, it was. It never really worked particularly well, unfortunately.
It was,
I'd look at his lines all day.
Well, his watercolour work was fantastic as well. But,
but
anyway, so the Book of the Dead came a bit later. They wrote a bit of Dredd. I think it's fair to say that Grant Morrison's involvement in this one is limited, because he doesn't even, this is the kind of collection that came out. Mark Miller and Dermot Power get a kind of biography at the start, and Grant Morrison doesn't. So lend me to think that, like, Grant Morrison basically probably wrote a napkin's worth of ideas down, and then Mark Miller wrote this. And when you read it, I'm not letting Morrison off the hook or anything. He's capable of writing terrible Judge Dredd stuff. But this really does feel like a Mark Miller comic, rereading it. But I remember just being so disappointed by this. But then the other day, like, Graham and Jeff were talking about this whole period, and I was like, I sort of want to read it just to see what I think of it. And so I got this collection. I mean, you know, like I say, it was not expensive. And this is Judge Dredd going to Egypt. And so you get, like, Egyptian judges who have this kind of quasi-pharaoh look to them.
Fucking hell, did no one, like, not die in this massive nuclear war that decimated the planet?
It started off being so, like, oh, there's the Russians, and there's, like, the East Coast and West Coast of America, and then that's about it. And then they're like, oh, no, there's Brexit. And then,
Garth Ennis comes on and says, no, there's the Irish judges.
Yeah, there's the Irish judges, and they all drink Guinness and stuff. And then, you know, you had, like, Calhab Justice, the Pan-African judges.
Anywhere that speaks English, they have their own judges. People who speak English, they've got their own judges.
So there's, like, Japanese Hondo Sit, there's China, which is Sino Sit, there's everywhere.
All of Africa has a sit.
And then
you know all of
well.
Africa, but I didn't know Egypt. Egypt's separate from Africa, isn't it? Because it's got like pyramids.
Lo and behold, this shit is, it's pretty racist. Let's not fuck about. It's written in the sort of lad phase of Miller and Morrison's writing career, where it was all a bit like, so this is like, oh, it's set in Egypt. So chief judge looks like a pharaoh and has actual sort of slaves sitting around his chair. The pyramids are in it. There's mummy in it. It's like fucking, I mean, it's literally like every single cliche of Egypt you could have is in there. And then you've got this really very meat and potatoes plot about a sort of mummy killing judges, and Judge Dredd being set up by a crooked Egyptian judge to be sacrificed because the mummy wants the good Dredd genes that, because he's part Judder. I don't know. It makes no sense. It's complete nonsense. It's fucking awful. It's fucking awful. But what I did sort of feel was that they're clearly going for a sort of a bit more of a fast-moving, action-packed take on Dredd. And there's a certain dumb blockbuster quality about some of this. Dermot Power's art is really nice. I always liked Dermot Power, and his art is great. And there's, like, you know, a full page sort of shot of this, you know, judge ship appearing, arriving at Luxor, the city, which is this futuristic city in the desert set inside a kind of see-through pyramid. I mean, it's all very cliche, but it's a kind of like, it's quite a jaw-dropping, beautiful moment in a way. And so it's kind of got this big, dumb kind of quality to it, and it's sort of readable. It doesn't, like, but it's fucking awful. I mean, it's just so shit, you know what I mean? Like, we're just talking about how good and subtle Wagner is, and how skillfully he does it, and then this is just the most boneheaded bullshit. And Dredd is just like an absolute prick, which, again, it's, I don't mind, because I've just finished reading a load of early Dredd where he is a bit of a prick. But this is just like, there's nothing to him. He just keeps saying, "Come a little closer, Carmen, and I'll forgive you with my boot." And he's just, all he says is stuff like that the whole time. "Anyone with any guts, meathead? Yeah, well, I got news for Angkor. Dredd's off the menu. Smack, crack, smash, kick, punch, headbutts." It's just really, he's just a really unlikable dickhead, basically. And you can tell that Mark Miller kind of hates writing him, and it comes out really clearly in the writing. It's bad. It's really bad. And they did do, there was one more strip they did called Crusade, which I've never read, which features loads of judges from around the world, the Vatican City judges and all that shit, teaming up. Never read that. That's next on the menu. That's what I want to read next in my shit Dredd odyssey. Yeah, very bad. Right, you go. I've just talked for ages.
I can't wait to hear about that. Well, I mean, I could talk about other things. I mean, my bladder is sort of, and the temperature in this car is sort of, in space, is
punishing.
Sort of, yeah, it's sort of going to call time on things. Mm. Well, if I've been reading, I read The Fantastic Four, issue 500, part of the Wade Waringo run. Yeah, man, that was good. I liked that. I liked it, but I liked Marvel Comics back when. I also picked up, I haven't finished it yet, I was reading it on the toilet today. Another thing that Tam suggested, which is Monsters on the Prowl. It's, I think, 2008.
Oh, yeah. I know this well. Great
by
stuff.
By Steve Nars and Duncan Fregredo.
Yeah.
You got it. You read it.
I think I may have talked about this ages and ages and ages ago, but fuck it. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I forget, but no, loving that. And it just feels like, was that when that, what's the name of the editor in chief? There was two editor in chiefs, wasn't there?
Axel Alonso.
I can't remember off the top of my head. I can't take it out of the bag, and like, I've just dropped a thing down the side of my car. It was just like, oh yeah, no man, fucking, I remember liking Marvel Comics. Mm. It's like the Marvel Cinematic Universe, like, it's like editorially everything in the Marvel Universe sort of got whipped into line a bit.
Yeah.
And there was a time where you'd get sort of two-part Spider-Man stories drawn by Ted McKeever with him.
Yeah, yeah.
Like Spider-Man versus someone who was really into grammar.
Quisada and Jemas era was kind of, yeah, they were sort of throwing any shit.
Bill Jemas, yeah.
Yeah.
Bill Jemas, I think, was the one who should have stayed. You know, I don't know.
Well, you know.
I don't know too much about that situation. I'm not a,
well, I think he's a problematic dude in some ways, but at the same time, there was
a certain, is he? Oh, God.
Well, I think he was a bit of a dick, really, but I also think he was up for just, like, shaking things up and trying out stuff, and that's really welcome. Because I think around that time as well, the Monsters on the Prowl thing, they did a bunch of like those kind of horror-y, comedy horror ones. Because they did, was it Fin Fang 4.
Yeah, Fin Fang 4.
The Roger Langridge
Marvelous.
One. That was so good.
Really good.
That was so yeah. good. Where they had to get jobs. All those monsters.
Yeah, they got shrunk and got jobs.
That was like, that's like the ultimate Gary Lactis comic.
Yes. Yes, it is. Yes. And yeah, this is coming close. You got the Thing and the Hulk, Bruce Banner hanging out, and it's got the most wonderfully brief, like 2-page setup. The Collector, whose main base is below Canada, has loads of monsters. The Mole Man's jealous. He burrows in. All the monsters escape. Oh no. And it's done so quickly. There's nothing ponderous. I just find the pacing of a lot of modern mainstream superhero big two comics, and by extension, you know, all the people doing Image comics who want to be doing big two comics, or like, you know, or think that that's like a template of how you should be doing things. Just this pacing of a lot of modern comics really gets on my tits, and
yeah.
it just seems so fucking wrong when comics are so thin and cost so much.
Yeah.
I just think it's awful, and there's really is not that many people doing it right. Al Ewing is. Fucking who I don't read enough of them to nowadays to pull any names out of my arse, but Bill and Ted's stuff is good. I picked up Pirate Corpse by Evan Dorkin, who of course is writing Bill and Ted now. Mm. with old Zoot guy, just mentioned him. What's his name?
Roger Langridge.
Roger Langridge doing the art. Yeah, that's a lot of fun and dense and good. But yeah, man. Yeah, it's a shame, isn't it, about comics?
Yeah. It's a shame about
Yeah, Pirate Corpse. I've got this. I haven't finished reading it yet. Very different. Very different reading, like, Evan Dorkin's first work and his most recent work sort of simultaneously at the moment. And so what it's like some sort of, like, he really likes Micronauts and space stuff.
It starts
it's
off
sort
as
of
a...
done vaguely sort of irreverently.
Well, it started off, what have you got? Because there's a whole bunch of
I've got, I've got Pirate Corpse, the Blunder Years.
Okay,
number
right.
I believe is the first two issues.
Yeah, it came out originally. It was like a color comic, and it was published by like Pacific or something like that, and or Eclipse, I can't remember. But then it went to black and white, and then yeah, it started off quite straight, and then it very quickly became more of a sort of a bit like the way like the mechanic stuff in Lost, you know, Jaime's work. Sort of starts to fade, and it becomes more like the Hoppers stuff is a bit more what he's into. So the sci-fi starts to drift away, and Pirate Corpse becomes a lot more about being like a 20-something who's into music and has trouble with relationships and all that, and gets drunk a lot. And is, you know, it just becomes a 20-something comic, but it's just got a loose sci-fi setting. But it starts off, and it's pretty much it's quite a weird. Straight sci-fi with a bit of a quirkiness to it. It's odd, yeah
that's what I've read so far. So right, yeah, I'll keep going.
Yeah, I mean,
I look forward to that.
There's a bunch of it. He put out a bunch of issues before eventually just it sort of just petered off, but it's, I mean, I always like a bit of Dorkin, whatever, really. It's just
yes. We need to stop.
Yeah, you need to go wee and get.
I do. Yeah. I do. I've ever since I thought I was doing it quietly, and it was clearly audible. on the podcast, and I will not do that to you again, dear listener. So here we go. Let's go now from reviewers. Flying from my car into a toilet. I've also, it's quite late now. I mean, Lady Lactus will be in bed, and I will have to sneak in. And just before I came out, she said, "You, I think you need a bath." Yeah, okay. I'm clearly emanating smells. Thank you so much for listening, dear listener. I love you, dear listener. I love you. Will you go steady with me?
I hope so. I hope you're not going to love him and leave him, old Gary Lactus. His heart can't take that.
No, it can't. And I want to go steady with every single one of you lovely listeners, especially the lovely listeners who contribute to our Patreon, patreon.com/silence. Thank you so much. And that's there. And I'm not going to promote it. I'm just going to say thank you to those who do. And it's cold in my car. My feet are so cold now. And what doesn't help, it's a fucking curse. Like, I got given some really, really nice fluffy slippers. Mm. And for Christmas a couple of years ago, and I've got really into them this winter, and it's so that I've got so into them that it actually makes me sad just the thought of leaving the house.
Oh.
Cuz I've got to take them off, and none of my shoes, no shoe and sock combination can compete to my fluffy slippers.
I can't wait for you to get back to them.
Yeah, just imagine if you've got some comfy slippers, dear listener. I hope that you get back to them soon, and as I will get back to mine. And much like a lovely cup of tea, one of the things you can get on Patreon, of course, is the Gary Lactus prunes, which The Beast Must Die has often described as a lovely audio cup of tea. And there's lots of other things there. We've said this so many times, we don't need to say it again. Would you like to say anything else, The Beast Must Die?
Oh, no, I've said plenty. We will speak to you again soon, dear listeners.
Yes, and The Beast Must Die, thank you so much for largely carrying this episode.
Just turns out I had a lot to say. I didn't even get to the thing I was going to do, which was to make you do a bit of an adventure game book, but we'll do that next time. That's fine.
Oh, maybe I could just piss in this seat.
I think we'll save it. We could probably get quite a lot of mileage out of that.
Oh, God, yeah. Oh, yeah, man, let's do another episode soon.
Yeah, maybe here. We just do soon.
No, what were you going to say?
Well, I was going to say we could do a whole episode dedicated to you doing an adventure game book live. This is a terrible idea.
What if you were doing an adventure game book, and which I had to make choices in, whilst simultaneously I was doing a different adventure game book, which you had to make choices.
Yes, now that would be exciting. Crisis on Infinite Game Book Earths. Let's fine tune this.
But the book changes each time. From the classic Ian Livingston fighting fantasy series, I presume.
No, that's the point. It's not from that, and that's why I'm excited about you doing it, because I think you're going to like it. It's not fighting fantasy.
Now there's a tease. Next time, here.
Oh. On. Silence!